Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Episode 2, The Genome Was the Puzzle. In this episode, Ryan and Juliana meet with Dr. Valerie Sosa to learn about the Rhododendron Williamsianum Genome Sequencing Project, how a visionary researcher led a huge team of scientists on an epic adventure to tackle a 30,000-piece puzzle that took 10 years and a whole lot of persistence to complete. Reflecting on the words of the immortal Smokey Robinson, loves a puzzle, confusing as can be, but work it out and you'll discover the beauty of love's mystery.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the second episode of For the Love of Rhododendron. We hope you enjoyed the first episode and glad that you're tuning back in. If you're new, welcome. We're talking about all things rhododendron and why we love them. So I'm glad that you're here with us on our journey. Today's episode, we're going to be talking about genomes, particularly rhododendron Williamsianum genome. Genome is just a fancy word for all the DNA inside of a cell and sequencing of that DNA. So I guess we can go around and introduce ourselves again for the beginning of this podcast. Maybe you recognize my voice from the first one. But I'm Ryan Fuller, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Chicago.
I'm Juliana Medeiros. I'm a plant scientist at the Holden Arboretum.
I'm Valerie Sosa. I was a research scientist in Benjamin Hall's lab at the University of Washington, and that lab is the lab that generated the genome for rhododendron Williamsianum.
That's great. Maybe if you picked up the new voice is Dr. Valerie Sosa. She's our guest today. So we'll be asking Valerie a lot of questions about her involvement in the genome sequencing project and just wherever else the conversation leads, I suppose. But we have a great conversation lined up with Val. So Valerie, I guess maybe just tell us a little bit more about what's been going on with the Hall Lab in particular, and I guess then we'll lead into the genome talk.
Well, the Hall Lab in general is in reference to the lab of Benjamin Hall at the University of Washington in Seattle, and you might hear me call it the UW or the UW during our conversation, but that's what I mean. And he was a professor first in the Department of Genetics and then in the Department of Biology. And he studied the evolution of rhododendrons probably since the mid 90s. And unfortunately he recently passed away in 2018, I believe it was. I had the pleasure of working in his lab for the last 6 years. And with his passing, unfortunately, we had to close the lab down in January of this year. But I was involved in a number of projects in his lab, including some genomic projects on rhododendrons, and as well as trying to untangle relationships among different species of rhododendrons. Prior to me joining there, the lab mostly used maybe like one or three genes from rhododendron genomes to try to figure out how they were related to each other by looking at the sequences of these genes. And I think that was primarily what they did in the early 2000s, late 1990s. And then new sequencing technology emerged in the 2000s. And with that, I think Ben decided, a lot of model plants, crops, their genomes are being sequenced, and there isn't a rhododendron genome sequence yet, and that's a pretty important horticultural plant. And so he, I think, was interested in using this new sequencing technology to sequence a genome. Prior to this, we would sequence genes that were maybe like 800 characters in length, or, you know, 1,000 characters in length of coding. And that would take a really long time to do for 100 or so species. But then with these new sequencing technologies, and you could sequence a lot of genes from a lot of species. They started doing that before I entered, was generating this genome and using these sequencing technologies to get a lot of genes to look at, to try to uncover the evolutionary history of the group. And when I came, having this genome, it wasn't published yet, but having the genome was really useful for other projects that we started working on when I started. And one of them was, we wanted to figure out how the tropical groups of species, otherwise known as viraeas, how they were related. There's about 300 species. And prior to that, a couple of genes had been looked at in the group, and there was conflict between the genes. And so, you know, we weren't really sure, like, how are they related to one another? And so then we were able to sample a bunch of genes, and we used the genome to kind of figure out what genes to use. And in doing that, we've actually find now that there's actually a lot of hybridization in the tropical species. And that's why, you know, there used to be conflict when people looked at one or two genes. But by looking across a lot of genes, you can then see more larger patterns among species. And so we've found a lot of hybridization among the viraeas. And then I'm really interested in flower shape. This is going to totally go off on a different tangent now, but I'm really interested in flower shape. And the tropical viraeas are super amazing because they're so different in their flower shape. They have more tubular flowers, and if you could compare them to the temperate species. And sometimes these tubes can be, the tubes of the flowers can be curved at the top or at the bottom. They also have different lengths of stamens. They're primarily this one form where there's red tubular flowers, and their flowers are curved at the top of the flower, and then they have longer upper stamens than lower stamens. And so people thought, well, these are probably have evolved to in tandem with birds for bird pollination, so that the pollen can be deposited in the back of the bird's head. So I'm super excited. And then there's all these other, this other floral diversity in the tropical group that I never knew about in rhododendrons. So I got super excited about them. And so became interested in studying genes that might be involved in these changes in flower shape in the tropical group. And one of the things about having a genome is that if, you know, there is a model plant snapdragon, and people have identified several genes that are involved in controlling the shape of that plant. And so if you know the sequence or the code of those genes, you can look for similar genes in another genome. And so we've been able to, you know, find similar genes in the rhododendron genome and then in Williamsenum genome, but that's not the genome we're interested in studying. We're interested in studying these tropical groups, but we don't have genomes for them. But you can fish out similar genes from species that don't have genomes by, and this might be like complicated to explain, but if you know like some regions that are similar across a lot of plants in that gene, you can use those regions and fish out similar regions in other species using like lab techniques. And then you can actually get that gene and then uncover the code behind that gene. So we've been able to use, like, you know, these, we call them candidate genes that we found from Antirrhinum, and find them in the Williamsenum genome, and then fish them out from other species in the lab of rhododendrons, so that we can look at how these genes have changed over time, and to see if that's related to like flower shape changing over time in the viraeas. And it's been like super interesting and cool. I'm so excited about it. And we're ready to submit a paper like in a couple of weeks. So you'll be able to hear more about that later.
This is very cool. So many different aspects of the genes that, you know, it seems like on paper, it's just a sequence of letters, but they're really manifesting all this diversity that we love. The shapes of the flowers, the color, the interaction with the pollinators. That's really cool. I can see why you're super excited about it.
And rhododendrons are so complicated. One of the things, and that's what we are learning every time we like delve into something, like it gets more complicated than we thought it was going to be. And for example, these flower shaped genes, we found like 5 different copies of them in rhododendron that are probably contributing to the like differences that we see. Like some of the copies are lost and new copies arise, and that is probably what's contributing to the changes in flower shape, the huge diversity of flower shape that we see in the tropical group.
I wanted to ask you, Valerie, more about the conflict between genes that you mentioned. What is that about? What do you mean by conflict, and how does that relate to deciding who's what species?
Different genes have different histories. And, you know, if there's only like 2 forms of a gene, it's pretty easy to like trace that history over time. But if there's lots of forms of that gene, it makes it a little bit harder to figure out like what was the ancestral form and what's the more like the more evolved or derived form. And so that's probably dependent on, sometimes dependent on like the gene. Sometimes it's dependent on how much time has passed between species diverging from one another. And it also depends on like how big a species, like how many individuals of a species existed at one period in time. So it's pretty complex, but for a variety of reasons, you can get different genes have different histories over time.
And so when you do like a family tree of species, this basically manifests depending on which gene you pick to look at, you'll get a different family tree, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Or, you know, if the genes have similar histories, then you might get a similar inference of relationships among species.
I'm simplifying by calling it a family tree, but I hear you retracting to the more accurate language.
I might have accidentally. So family tree, genealogy, evolutionary tree, phylogeny, I might say any of those things, and they're the same thing.
They're all the same thing.
That's one of the hard things I think about genetics for lay people and myself is the number of terms and how they're so technical. And often when I try to simplify language in terms of genetics and evolutionary relationships, my colleagues will come back and say, oh, well, yes, and they make it more accurate again. So I think it's a hard thing to talk about. It's not easy to talk about. You have to know a lot about what the expertise of the person that you're talking about is. And so you're always making these calculations in your head, like how much should I tell them? Or how much should I just like reserve the details and kind of float above those details? So I have one more question on that. Does the large number of copies, is that a factor in this? Is the copy number that you mentioned in flower shape and size contributing to this?
It could also confuse things in trying to figure out relationships of species, because if you have if you have gene copies that are really similar to one another, or the number of genes, it's hard to know which ones are more closely related to each other. And so that does also make things more challenging in rhododendron as well, and in plants in general.
Yeah, plants have a surprising array of genome sizes. As I've found through a lot of my sequencing projects, it's kind of, actually rhododendron's genome is on the smaller side compared to some plants that have literally like trillions of base pairs, if not more, like what we call gigabases. You know, the more gigabases you have, the bigger your genome is. So it's tough. It can be tough to understand which genes to pick. And luckily there's people that are much smarter than I am that are making algorithms and computer programs that can do that for me. But
yeah, and it depends on how the method of gene duplication, like for example, I'll just start jumping into the William Cianum Genome Project. One of the most interesting things we found was that even though William Cianum is diploid now, which means when you look at a cell and you look at the nucleus, it has 2 sets of chromosomes, one from the mom, one from the dad. And for rhododendron, that's usually 13 chromosomes from mom and 13 chromosomes from dad. So even though William's CNM is diploid, which has only two sets of chromosomes, when we sequenced the genome, our goal was there had been one rhododendron genome that was published in 2017 for rhododendron dalibi. And they sequenced the genome of that. And so sequencing a genome means a variety of things. So what they did is that what they wound up having was they had all these pieces of DNA sequences that represented the genome as a whole, but they didn't know what sequences those chromosomes belong to or where along each chromosome those sequences belonged. So they basically had, I like to think of it as like a puzzle. The genome is the puzzle, and then the pieces are all these like DNA, short DNA sequences. Each represents a puzzle piece. And so they didn't really know, I guess they had all the puzzle pieces, but they didn't know where the puzzle pieces went on the puzzle.
Wow.
And then when we did the William Cianum project, the goal at the beginning was to map all the sequences that we got and try to get them assembled onto individual chromosomes and ordered along the chromosomes. And when we did that, we were then able to see that, hey, there's a gene on this chromosome that's also very similar to another gene on this other chromosome and another gene on this other chromosome and another gene on this other chromosome. And so because they tended often to be on different chromosomes. And then we also compared our genome to other plant genomes that are closely related to it and some that are more distantly related to it. And by doing that, you could kind of see that, well, these duplicated genomes are actually also in these other plants that are distantly related to rhododendron William Cianum. And so that indicates that that these genes duplicated a long time ago from like a whole genome, what we call a whole genome duplication, which is basically all of the chromosomes doubled. But then over time, genes are lost and the chromosomes kind of go back to being two sets of chromosomes instead of four sets of chromosomes. That's one way where you can get a lot of gene copies is by these whole genome duplications that have happened a lot in plants and happened a long time ago. So for example, in William Cianum, we actually found evidence for two whole genome duplications that happened probably about 180 million years ago and another one about 120 million years ago. And so some of those copies have been retained over time in William Cianum and others have been lost. But so that's one way of getting a lot of copies. I think I was trying to remember where I started from this, but I think that, so that's one method of getting a lot of gene copies is whole genome duplication. And then another method that we found, for example, with the flower shape genes is that because we have this genome and we know what genes are on each chromosome, we can actually see that these flower symmetry genes are, there's like five of them that are right next to each other on the same chromosome. And so those kinds of copies are called tandem gene duplication, which is a different mechanism, but genes are copied right next to each other along the same chromosome. And that has happened probably more recently in rhododendron. So it's got a lot of gene copies, and then they're from different mechanisms. So you have some that are really old from the whole genome duplication and some that are newer from the tandem gene duplication. And usually the newer ones are more similar to each other than the older gene copies. The older gene copies have kind of diverged from one another. And gene copies are important because when a gene duplicates, oftentimes one can evolve a new function and that might help a plant adapt to like a new environment. So a lot of these mechanisms of gene duplication are important for plants to adapt to new conditions.
So I guess since we're on that train down the genome sequencing path, how does one sequence a genome? Or how did this particular genome get sequenced? Because I think it was pretty special, right?
Yeah, there was a lot involved for the rhododendron William Cianum genome project. And at the time there were, I think, three research scientists in Ben Hall's lab that were working with Ben. Ben decided he wanted to sequence a rhododendron genome, but he didn't know how to do it. So he contacted this professor in the Department of Genome Sciences at the UW named Jay Shinder, and he's a well-known human geneticist that is always up to speed on the newest technologies and also develops new technologies for doing like human genomics. And so Ben had approached him to see if they would collaborate and help out on this project. And really that was pivotal because he had, I think, maybe four different grad students that all specialized in different techniques that without all of them, this probably wouldn't have come to fruition. At least it wouldn't have come to fruition. But maybe around that time, sequencing technologies could sequence. Well, this was one thing that one of the former research scientists in Ben's lab told me is when they started, sequencing machines could only sequence 36 bases or characters of DNA. So that makes it hard when you have these short pieces to try to get the whole puzzle. It works better if your puzzle pieces are longer than shorter. It takes more time and it's harder to figure out where those short pieces go. So, they thought, well, I don't think we're going to be able to sequence the entire genome with just, you know, having these fragments that are just 36 bases long. So they were just going to start like with a percentage of the genome. But then I think like a couple months in, then the technology had advanced so that you could then sequence 100 bases or characters. So then they decided, well, let's sequence the entire genome. I guess just to sequence a genome and not map it to chromosomes. All you do is you shear the genome into fragments, and then you sequence the end of those fragments. So you have partial sequences of each fragment, and then you try to overlap those so that you can get one long strand of DNA, which is your puzzle, the one long strand of DNA. And so that's what they did initially. So they had a bunch of sequences, and I think maybe what they ended up with was around 12,000 sequences. But they didn't know where those sequences belonged, what chromosome or where on that chromosome those sequences were. And so that's when one graduate student was involved with just sequencing the 12,000 or so fragments of DNA. And another one became involved in trying to combine some of those fragments to get even longer strands. And then another graduate student came involved, and he knew about this other kind of technology where if you add, I think probably most people know what formaldehyde is. If you add formaldehyde to some cells, regions that are next to each other on the chromosome are linked, and then you can sequence those. And then you know that these, you know, sequences from these two regions are next to each other on a chromosome when you get the sequences back. That method was one method we call, you might hear me say Lachesis or HiC sequencing. Hopefully you won't. But so that was one method of trying to map the sequences to chromosomes. And what we wound up doing was two methods, right? So we had this one method, but we didn't know how good it was going to be at mapping the sequences to chromosomes. So we wanted to do another method, and so that we could be confident where they corresponded, that was true, that those sequences actually did go to that chromosome and at a particular location. So then Ben's lab did another method. So the Shinder lab did the first method of trying to map sequences to chromosomes. And then Ben's lab did another method where they basically did two crosses. Well, it's called a linkage map. And what you do is you do two crosses. You do a cross between two different species, and then you grow up the offspring. And then you cross one of the parents to those offspring. And then you grow up those offspring. And then how the offspring looks, like each offspring has like different forms of genes, but you can look at the frequencies of the different forms of genes and figure out which genes are closely related on a chromosome. And then we looked for those genes in the genome and figured out that they were, you know, that they were next to each other, and then were able to map those matching sequences and put them onto a chromosome together in a particular order. So there were these two methods, and that gave us confidence in where the 12,000 sequences were located on the chromosomes of William seeing them. That's basically the sequencing part. And then I mentioned we did some analyses and compared the William Seeingham genome to other genomes to try to figure out the whole genome duplications that had happened in William Seeingham. And if I lost anybody, let me know and I'll try to, try to explain it.
Yeah, that sounds like there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen for this project. I didn't realize that there were so many graduate students that had like come in at the perfect time, basically, it sounds like, too.
Yeah.
To yes. lend their skills to the overall caring of the project, I guess.
So in terms of scope, how many years approximately, how many people approximately? It's huge.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, I'm not too sure when exactly the project started, but I was looking through some of Ben's presentations on the genome they had given to people in the past, and I found one from around like 2009. Where he was talking about the concept of sequencing a rhododendron genome and kind of like the beginnings of the project. So I'm sure it started before that, but it could have started before that, but I think maybe like around 2009. And then we wound up publishing it in 2019, so 10 years later, which took a long time. And there were so many people involved, and a lot of them had left. I think when I started in Ben's lab, he had had three research scientists, and they had all left that were involved in the project. To either one of them had retired, one of them went to pursue graduate school, and another one had moved to a different position. So there wasn't really anyone in Ben's lab when I started. There were just some undergraduate students working in his lab, and so this project hadn't been written up yet. And so Ben was trying to build his lab up again in 2014, and he hired myself and Elizabeth Ramage and Christopher Liu as three new research scientists. And we kind of picked up the project again and did some more analyses and started trying to get in touch with all of these people who had moved on to like other companies or working at hospitals, completely different fields. Someone's at Facebook. So we, you know, trying to get in touch with all of these people and get their methods and their results and putting it all together and writing this paper. So it was a feat because there were so many people involved. But yeah, I think so now, you know, on the paper, there's 11 co-authors.
Takes a village to raise a genome.
It does. And when you know, I think, you know, there was another side note. There's another genome that was published in Rhododendron last year on Rhododendron Simsii. And that one also, I actually haven't looked at all of the authors, but that one also has a ton of authors on it. And so you can see like how quickly the technology is changing, because on the Rhododendron Simsii genome, they also generated a chromosome level genome where they mapped sequences to chromosomes, but they use newer technology. And the newer technology now, you can get up like, I think it's up to like 10,000 bases of sequence. So you have these really long, like the really huge puzzle pieces. And so it's super easy to get the entire chromosome now. And so there they did, yeah, theirs is more complete than ours. And because they were able to use this newer sequencing technology. So as things move forward, hopefully it'll be easier for more and more chromosome level genomes to be generated, and yeah, easier and quicker than our 10-year project.
Yeah, I think even people who worked in like the late 90s who were like sequencing, I think I've seen documentaries where they were sequencing like the human genome, and just how much work that took with basic sequencers 20 years ago. I bet all those people who worked on those papers are blown away by the sequencing we have now. And even since I started my PhD, the sequencing technology has changed. So I wish I could go back and do
different. Yeah.
You just got to get it done at some point, because that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, it makes it challenging. Once you embark on something, it's already become outdated. So.
Yeah, basically, like next year, I think they're going to have something called like whole genome resequencing is already being used pretty widely, but the cost of that is coming down. And that's just essentially where you sequence part of the genome in one entire run. So you capture tens of thousands of genes and you just align your raw sequencing data back to, you know, Valerie's William C. Annam genome and see what you get. And you use areas that have the best coverage. So that way you can confidently call the DNA sequence at a certain location. And what we're trying to do essentially is just collect more data. Everybody just wants more and more and more data. I think at some point the like law of limiting returns kicks in or something. You know, people are starting to run analyses that even if you have 100,000 genes, it may not change the pattern of your family tree or your phylogeny that we talked about. You can still get the same results with like the 400 or 500 gene projects that we're working on now, you know, so, but still that's better than it was 10 or 15 years ago. It's just kind of insane.
What are some of the ways that people who are interested in rhododendron from different directions, what are some of the ways that we can expect this will improve our rhododendrons in our lives? So as an example, I was at a meeting this weekend with a lot of rhododendron enthusiasts. And you know what they want? They want to know what plant that is over there. And so I thought a little bit about the idea of barcoding, you know, which is a goal that I think a lot of people who are interested in biodiversity think about, which is essentially this idea that you could walk up to any plant and take its genes and say, who are you and who are your parents? So is that something that is on the horizon for us, or is there 20 more years of technology before we can do that?
I'll let Val dive in.
Well, I know. I mean, I know that's barcoding is a thing that has been talked about for a while. But mostly I think it's been using like one or few genes, you know, and sequencing one or a few genes. And, you know, if they can identify species. And I think that there's some limitation when you just do, you know, one or a few genes, because you might be able to get it to family or genus, but getting it to species is harder, because sometimes those genes are conserved, they don't change that much. And so, you know, a lot of members in the genus will have the same sequence. I haven't kept up on using, you know, using like genome-wide regions to barcode species. Have you, Ryan?
I mean, I was at a meeting a couple of years ago at the Field Museum here in Chicago, where, you know, one of our DNA technicians was sent to Germany or something to this company called, I think it's called like Nanopore or something. That's the type of sequencing. I can't remember what the name of the company is, but she got to go over there and do like a 7-day training or something like that. And then she brought back this little sequencer that was like, I don't know, like the size of a mouse on a computer mouse. And it's a USB DNA sequencer, and that just kind of blew me away. And you can get really long sequences, like 1,000 base pair reads from these little sequencers, and you can just do it on your laptop. So I think what companies are trying to push is, you know, DNA sequencers that you can use in the field. And we also saw another one that was literally an entire kind of genetics lab. It was like a very little box, and all of the chemicals that you need to do a DNA sequencing run were included in that little box. So the only thing that you needed to add was DNA and push go. it just sequences. You have to pick, I think it's still limited by, you have to pick the genes that you want. So there is, you know, that's where the genome that comes in handy. You can pre-select the genes that you want to avoid some of the problems that we talked about, you know, like duplications or whole genome duplications or conserved genes. You know, you don't want conserved genes because it's not useful. You want some diversity in your sequences to be able to tell species apart. So I think we're still kind of away from the dream of like a pocket sequencer that you can just go stamp a leaf or a flower petal or something, and it tells you like, oh, you know, rhododendron, your favorite rhododendron species in your garden. I think we're still quite a ways away from that. And there's still so many amazing questions to be asked for species and rhododendron anyways. It's just, as Valerie said, it's extremely complicated for the natural history of the groups. We still need a lot of work done there.
One thing that I thought about I see a lot of value in genomes for things I'm interested in, but to people that are interested in growing rhododendrons or hybridizing rhododendrons, I think having these chromosome level genomes for a variety of rhododendrons would be awesome, because you can compare them and see where there's been like structural changes in chromosomes. And if that happens, it's less likely you're going to be able to breed two species together when their chromosomes have like changed and genes aren't in the same place on one chromosome as they are in another species chromosome. So you're not going to be able to breed two things easily, two species easily, if there's been changes, structural changes along the chromosome. So I think that could be useful for selectively breeding certain species.
Here's an ignorant question. So my study is basically traits. So what's that leaf? What is it doing? How do those leaves of different species interact with the environment? And sort of one of the next steps of my work is to work with somebody who basically looks for candidate genes, looks for what is the actual genetic sequence that's causing that difference between these species. And so that's where I get excited. I need a collaborator, right? Because obviously I don't know about this. And science is so complex right now, you need collaborators to do anything anymore. And so I'm excited to start thinking about where can I identify these traits that I've been working on. So say, you know, how thick is the leaf? How many stomata does the leaf have on it? Is that controlled genetically? Is it controlled by the environment? And then bringing that ability in to find those candidate genes eventually. So that's what I'm excited about, is learning the genetics. What is the traits of diversity on Earth? And then how does that relate to the genes? Because that's the heart of evolution, is understanding the genetic differences. So to me, I think each time, as a person who studies species and wants to compare species, I guess the question I wonder is, do we need every species, or someday can we start? You talked a little bit about candidate genes and inferences. So is it just a matter of getting enough that we can start making these inferences?
Yeah, I don't think it makes it a lot easier if you have the genomes for fishing out genes in species you're interested in studying. But you can do that without a genome. You can find candidate genes from species you're interested in studying. And we did that with genes with flower shape. We found, you know, candidate genes, three different kinds of candidate genes from two species that we didn't have genomes for. But we used the William C. Anum genome to find those genes in the William C. Anum genome, and then use those to fish out the genes from the two Viraea species we were studying. And yeah, and it's, you know, so there's different ways that can affect what genes, you know, like affect differences in morphology. You can have changes that happen like in the coding of the gene. You can also have, you know, changes in upstream genes that are turning your candidate genes on and off. So there can be changes in those genes. And I think there can also be downstream changes. There could be, you know, something after the gene is being turned on, there can be something downstream that's like blocking it. So there's lots of ways for genes to be functioning differently in different species. And I think like in our case with the flower symmetry genes, like we found five different copies of one particular flower symmetry gene, and they're all doing different things in the flowers, but we couldn't pinpoint like what changes in the code are creating those differences, right? I think we would have to look at other genes that are involved that might be upstream or downstream of them as well.
This is so cool. Every time I think about this stuff, I just get lost in excitement. Could the genome help us understand traits that seem to be inextricably correlated? Because when I look at one of the things in my field is looking at sometimes there seems to be this inescapable association between two traits. And the question becomes, is it because they are genetically linked? And is that something that we can think about with the chromosome size information?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes if genes are linked, they're usually next to each other on the chromosome. And so that, like having that locational information from a chromosome level genome, you could then look at genes that are next to one, you know, next to ones that you're interested in. And it could be too that one gene is doing more than one, you know, it's affecting more than one feature in your thing of interest. Like for example, going back to the flower shaped genes or the, you know, we found this one gene that is, I'd mentioned these red tubular flowers where they're curved along the top part of the flower and then the upper stamens are longer than the lower stamens. So there's one gene that's actually affecting the growth of both of those organs. So the upper petals and the upper stamens are longer than the lower petals and the lower stamens. And those are correlated, the long stamens and long petals. And it's the same gene that's doing that in those two different organs.
So you'd have a hard time breaking those traits up if you try to breed, right? If they're closely linked on a chromosome, it's going to be hard to
it's
unlinked.
If they are closely linked on a chromosome, it's harder. You can have it happen at a low level, but you would probably have to screen a lot of offspring from crosses to get that morphology you're looking for, where they've been unlinked.
What are you excited about? What do you want to know about genomes and your work, Ryan? What do you want to use it for?
Oh, geez, yeah. A multitude of things. Like I get excited about, I think when I saw the Viraya collection at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, I was just blown away. That's just so cool. They have them in pots just growing right next to each other. When I was there, they all happened to be flowering at the same time. So I just was like a little kid in a candy shop there. So I think that that's really neat. And unraveling some of the pollinator relationships in rhododendron is really cool too. But right now I am studying what Valerie talked about, the whole genome duplication. So most rhododendrons are diploid. So they have just the two copies of the chromosomes in their cells, but there's some wonky little groups like Triflora and Lepanica and Medinia, you know, some of these lepidote rhododendrons that have just crazy amounts of chromosomes. In some cases, like up to eight copies in every single cell from some of the research that I've been working on with Lepanica. So that was totally unexpected and has added an extra complication of layers to my dissertation that I did not foresee happening. So, you know, something like a genome can really help me align some of the, you know, the DNA sequences that I have to the genome and try to understand how many copies I have of a certain gene. And that might help me whittle out genes that are not so great in my data set. And they also may be able to help me understand the origins of that whole genome duplication. Was it recent? Was it older? Was it due to hybridization? Or, you know, are they just doing it in a single population or lineage? You know, all of those things can be assisted by a genome for sure. So it's really complicated, but it's pretty cool. Like the genomes are just doing all sorts of crazy things in rhododendron, specifically in the mountains of South Central China. There's just so much. And Val talked about hybridization too, and Viraya, and I think we're gonna come across a lot of hybridization here too. And I don't think that will surprise a lot of plant breeders who are listening that rhododendrons can hybridize with each other. I think it's something that makes them special, but also makes them really complicated if you want to study their natural history, because it's weedy.
Ryan, how did you figure out what genes to use in the groups that you're studying? Did you design candidate genes to use?
That's a great question. We tried just one of these universal bait kits first, what they call a universal bait kit. You know, there's been scientists who have collected genes from a bunch of different plants that we've found that you can find in all of them, basically, you know, to some variation. And as Val talked to, you can pull those genes out with sequencing and get those genes, and that they're usually pretty useful. I think for rhododendron, it was really hard because we have a lot of recent speciation going on. And so the genes are pretty highly conserved when you get down to like comparing individual species to one another. So we went back to the drawing board, and this was before the William C. Ainham genome came out, but we used the Delavi genome with some collaborators in China doing the whole genome resequencing that I talked about. And they're on their way to building, you know, a huge family tree for the non-Biraea rhododendrons. And we kind of used their data set to identify longer genes that we wanted. So I didn't want to do a whole genome sequencing and didn't have the money to do it, frankly. So I think I have right now like a pool of like 500 or 700 genes that we think are single copies, you know, based on all the results so far. It looks like they're behaving like single copies, but then you add in the fact that I know I'm working with plants that have multiple copies of their genome. They're not. So we know they're not singular, but it does help us narrow down the number of copies that we get in a single sequencing run. So to that degree, we wouldn't have been able to do that stuff without the genome. Yeah, it's great. I don't know what it's going to tell me. It's a real big mess right now for polyploids, but it's cool. It's really cool. I don't know what the origin of that duplication is for and why those particular groups continue to have it. Because usually whole genome duplication, it either doesn't last long in a group or it becomes, you know, embedded in a certain species and they become widely, you know, they their ranges can expand beyond that of like their parental species. So a lot of like the invasive plants that you see on roadsides and stuff, those are all polyploids, and polyploids are just a jargony term for plants who have more than two copies of each chromosome in their genome. But yeah, it'll be messy. I don't know if it's like a high alpine adaptation or a high mountain adaptation, but something is selecting polyploidy to hang around. I don't know what it is.
So that makes it even more challenging to try to use like barcoding methods in rhododendron, right? Because I think even for Biraeas, you know, our goal was to try to figure out, you know, which species was more closely related to which other species. And we couldn't with all of the data that we had. So because of all the hybridization, we're not confident on who's cousin to who. So we can identify like major groups that share common ancestors, but we because of all the hybridization, we can't be confident of who's more closely related to who. So
yeah, that's going to be an extra layer of the cake that I'm trying to eat right now, so to speak. it's going to be there, right?
Yeah, big cake.
But yeah, it's important for people to be up to the challenge of rhododendron, because otherwise we wouldn't be uncovering any of this stuff if we just used one gene.
So from what I heard, Ben Hull was not a rhododendron person or a plant scientist in his training, right? His no. background was in yeast, maybe?
Yeast, yeah, he was a yeast geneticist.
So this was a passion project. This wasn't his, quote, job. I mean, no. It became his job, but this was a labor of love, correct?
The rhododendron research was not what made him the money. He was a yeast geneticist, and I think he started at University of Washington in like the early 60s, maybe 1960s. But yeah, he has some pretty interesting history, because he was doing research around the time when people were figuring out how genes turn into proteins. People didn't know how genes turn into proteins. And Ben was one of the people that found like the intermediate form that you get when you go, you know, to make a gene turn into a protein.
So what's in a textbook, you mean?
Yes, what's in a textbook, yeah.
He was one of the people basically discovering those things we learn in Campbell's biology book.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Which is super cool. And so, yeah, so he was using yeast, you know, to figure all this stuff. And then I think figured out a way for yeast to produce certain proteins, like synthesized proteins, and use that to help develop vaccines. And so he wound up, I think, you know, his techniques for using yeast to synthesize proteins were used, I know, at least in like hepatitis maybe A and B vaccines and the human papillomavirus vaccine. So he wound up patenting the technology and got royalties from the research. And so I think in the 90s, he decided, he started, I think he told me that the director or chair of the Department of Genetics had gotten him interested in rhododendrons. Like he had some rhododendrons in his garden. And so Ben started getting into growing rhododendrons. And then I guess at one point, you know, he decided in the 90s to leave the Department of Genetics and he wanted to research rhododendrons. And I can understand why, right? They're so diverse. And I think he really got into, you know, gardening with them and seeing their diversity. And so he decided to start studying rhododendrons, and he was able to because he had money from his royalties on the vaccines to fund his own research. And so he moved to the Department of Biology and focused on rhododendrons. But he also, you know, he was more of a, you know, had more of like molecular training. And I think, you know, initially he didn't really know how to build family trees, but he was interested in doing this. So he figured it out. And his lab and another lab at the University of Washington Department of Biology were the ones that were, you know, doing like trying to uncover relationships among plant species. When I started there as a grad student in 2003. So I would interact with him as a grad student because another thing is because he had looked at these genes in yeast, RNA polymerase genes in yeast. And at the time when people are trying to build family trees of plants, they used like the same handful of genes and no one really branched out. And so he had worked on these RNA polymerase genes in yeast and was like, hey, these are really long genes. They've got a lot of sequence. Maybe, you know, they're pretty variable. Maybe I should try using these in rhododendrons. So he started using these genes from his yeast research in getting them from rhododendrons and trying to build family trees in rhododendrons. And it worked pretty well. And so I was trying to figure out relationships among bed straws for my PhD. And I was, you know, not having luck with the same genes everybody was using. So one of his grad students told me, go talk to Ben, see if, you know, talk to him about these yeast genes and see if you can use them in your group and they might help you. So that's how Ben and I started interacting. And then, yeah, and he stayed in biology and he retired. He was a professor emeritus, I'm trying to think, it was around 2010 or so he might've retired, but he still had an active lab until the day he died. He still had an active lab. He was so interested and passionate about rhododendrons and he just wanted to know more and more about them. So it was really cool to see that.
What a fascinating person. You know, that's how you keep your mind young. You just don't stop. You just keep asking more and more questions and keep going. So I know it was a big loss to rhododendron world when Ben passed away. So it's really great to get to hear your personal stories and how he helped you and how he really gave all of us this gift of this project. So I'm really grateful for that and that he found rhododendrons. It's what a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he made his mark in the organisms he studied.
He certainly did. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to talk a little bit more about the Rhododendron Research Network, and particularly about the discovery of the online rhododendron genomics database that's being curated by the Kunming Institute of Botany in China. Can you tell us a little bit more about that work that you were involved in?
Yeah, well, I guess, so I part of the steering committee for the Rhododendron Research Network, and I was working with another member, Bob Weissen, to try to develop online tools for rhododendron researchers. And one of the tools we had thought, because I had worked on the William Seanham genome and there had been these two other genomes that had come out, the Dalhousie genome and the Simsii genome, that to try to make a tool so it makes it easy for people to use these genomes, because if you want to use them, you know, you have to have some computational experience. If they're not set up for you in a user-friendly environment. And I discovered that, right? Because I didn't have any computational knowledge when I joined Ben's lab, and I wanted to use the Dalavi genome and the William Sanum genome, and had to go through this big learning curve on how to use them. So we wanted to develop this tool, and we were working on it. And then I don't remember how I stumbled across, I think I know now. So I think after the William Sanum genome was published, you know, a couple of Chinese researchers had contacted us and they asked us for our data. And I gave it, you know, we did make it. And then again, you know, we made it available on certain websites that are accessible to the public, but still not super user friendly. And so I gave them our data, and then I think I was maybe telling them about the rhododendron, you know, and then I contacted them later. I was like, hey, we're starting this rhododendron research network. I know you're, you know, you contact me about the genome that we published, come and get involved with the rhododendron research network. And this one person then said, good to know about you guys. We've generated this online tool to search rhododendron genomes called the Rhododendron Plant Genome Database. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you. Now we don't have to do it.
Ta-da.
And sent me the link. And so then I went to the link and I saw, yeah, and it's great. Like they have the rhododendron Dalavi, SimCI, and William Sanum genomes in a database. They are also working on rhododendron irroratum. They're working on a genome of that species. So they're going to get that also on their website. And then they have chloroplast genomes, which are different from the nuclear genomes that have chromosomes, but they are like another thing in a cell that has DNA. That's important for photosynthesis. Anyway, so they sequenced those genomes of Dalavi and Pulgrim. I think another paper had sequenced the genomes and they have that up. So basically they're trying to get any genomes that become available from rhododendron centralized on this website. And it's great because when you sequence a genome, another thing you want to do is, you know, you have all these DNA sequences, but genomes have a lot of like junk, we call junk DNA, that don't code for any genes. And then they have actual sequences that code for genes. And so when you sequence a genome, you have a bunch of DNA sequences, but you don't know what's junk and what's not junk. So another part of sequencing the genome is what we call annotating the genome. And so that's figuring out what genes are actually like in those DNA sequences. And so you identify like where on the sequence a particular gene is and what function that gene has. And so you can go into their tool and you can actually like look, they kind of have it's called like a browser window, or you can look along a chromosome at all of the genes that have been identified along a chromosome. And if you're interested in a particular, you can also like search the genes. If you're interested in a particular candidate gene for leaves and you know the name of it, you can search for that name in the Rhododendron Plant Genome Database and it'll bring up all of the genes that have that name and where they are in each genome. Yeah, so that, and also show you the location and the DNA sequence in case you want to try to fish that out. If you know you have the sequence, you can try to fish that gene out from other species that don't have genomes. So it's a super useful tool, and you don't have to know how to program. You just have these friendly graphical user interface with boxes you type things into and hit return and get things back. So it's good for people for whatever task they want accomplished.
Because no matter what you're doing, you're looking through a lot of puzzle pieces. And so these tools are critical. No matter what you're going to do with the genome, there's literally thousands and thousands and thousands. You can't possibly look at them in an Excel spreadsheet.
Right.
You need these technological tools to help you match things up and scan through them and all that. So.
Yes. Yeah. Because I think there's like maybe around like 30,000 genes in a rhododendron genome that have been identified. So that's a lot of genes to look through.
Can you name them? No. that was not a fair
not
question.
Not all 30,000.
And go.
Go.
So you mentioned, Valerie, that the hall lab closed. So what are your next steps in rhododendron research, or will you continue on with the plants in some way?
So we have a couple of projects that we're still trying to, we did experiments for in Ben's lab, and we still need to publish them. And so I'm no longer working at the University of Washington anymore. So in my free time, I am trying to write up these papers and get them published, because I think they're really cool papers. But we have like four papers that we still need to publish from work that was going on in Ben's lab. So I mentioned one of them that's really close, looking at flower shape genes in two viraeas that have different flower shapes, and looked at the different copies and how they're functioning. Each of the copies are functioning in the two different species. So that's really close to being submitted. And then I guess I'll go in order of in order of almost completed. And then we have another paper where we actually, having the William Seanham genome was useful for this, because we basically use this technique where we cut up the genome and then sequenced at those cut sites. And so, we had all of these short little pieces of sequence, and, we didn't know, which ones represented the same gene or which, and so having the genome, we were able to map all of these short pieces of sequences that we had to the genome and figure out, okay, all of these are this gene, all of these are this gene, all of these are this gene. And then we used thousands of genes to try to reconstruct the evolutionary history, the relationships of the viraeas. And that's what we discovered, widespread hybridization among the species. And so we're writing a paper on that. And we also worked with someone to try to kind of quantify flower shapes and look at how that has evolved in the group. And so that paper will be coming out next. And then this another project that started before I started was using the same kind of method to look at relationships among members of subgenus Hymenanthes, temperate species. And so that is a project where we have, that actually there's less hybridization in subgenus Hymenanthes. So that family tree is behaving a lot nicer than the Viraea family tree. And so that is something else that we're trying to wrap up and write up and publish. And then we have some more genomes that we sequenced that we're trying to make publicly available. And so these genomes are different. We actually basically sequenced all the genes that were turned on when we sampled these species. We don't have like the junk DNA in these genomes. We just have sequences of genes that were turned, all the genes that were turned on in the genome when we sampled these species. But we have, I think we've got Albiflorum, Albrechtii, Bearingenum, Camshaticum, Edgeworthii, Mole, and Taxifolium. That stuff that we want to get out to the public and make them useful to other people to use, because it kind of spans of a breadth of the genus, like a lot of the major subgenera. So it would be good for comparative things.
I finally heard some lepidote species are getting some love from the genome stuff. It's like, what's it going to take for someone to sequence something that I'm working on? Not to be selfish, but... Like, help a guy out here, Valerie.
Sorry, you should have given me a species. You should have given me a species with like cool flowers from your group, and we
that's it. Cool flowers, and then Valerie.
So I'm trying. I really, really, really like Elizabeth Ramage and I are still like trying our hardest to get these things published after the lab has closed, but we're both moving on to other things. So I will not be continuing rhododendron research after that, but I want to help lay the foundation for other people to continue studying them.
Well, you've done a lot already. So we were excited to talk to you because we see you as one of those people that's really laying that groundwork. And that's what this podcast is about, right? Is laying that groundwork to make sure that we can invite more people in. And I feel like the genome invites so many people in. It really invites just a world of different perspectives. And So I think that this is going to be a lasting contribution to rhododendron.
Along those lines, Valerie, do you have any advice for our listeners who are interested in rhododendron and genomes?
Persevere through all of the challenges they throw at you, because the more you uncover, the more interesting they become and the more complex you realize they are. But I will try to come up with some websites that kind of explain genomes in general for people that are interested in it. I don't know if I have any.
I guess my word of advice for people getting into genomes is like, you better be prepared for a ride of things changing constantly. That is just now, that's the new norm. For a long time, there was just the way of sequencing. And I think over the last decade or so, it's really, but it's great because some of the old tools are still very, very useful and still being used. So there's just a large repertoire of different weapons, I guess you can use now to come at genomes. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next decade.
It sounds like patience is the word of the day.
Definitely.
And it's, you know, the reason we love rhododendrons is because they're complex. And so to find out that that complexity is underlain by more complexity and more complexity.
At the molecular level, the morphological complexity is underlain by the molecular complexity.
It's not only skin deep, it's also genome deep. Right?
It's genome deep. Yeah, so patience on everybody's part, and just keeping trying. I feel like if we get more people involved, that's a key for me. More people being patient and frustrated. No, just kidding. More people. It's very interesting to think about how in this fast-paced society of, you know, modern life, we want things quickly. But it took 10 years to get this beautiful product that you have made, and at least 11 people. It sounds like more in the long run.
Yes, definitely so more in the long run.
If we can get more and more people involved and just committing that time. One of my favorite things that I had thought about in the past that sort of pushed me in the direction of wanting to get more collaborators in rhododendron was this concept that when you start building a genetic framework, and then you add ecology, evolution, medicinal chemistry, all those things on top of it, now you're really cooking with gas, right? Now you're like looking for a way to like link all of these different aspects of biology, and having that genome is like the core. It's like the heart of that variation. It's the driving factor. So to me, it feels like a centralizing focal point that will help drive rhododendron as being one of the major study groups, you know, going forward.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think we've covered just about everything that we wanted to and more. So I just want to thank you, Valerie, for coming on today and talking with Juliana and I. It was really great.
Thank you for inviting me, Ryan and Juliana. I think this is awesome, considering especially that Ben Hall passed away and he was super excited about the William C. Ingham Genome Project and never actually got to see the publication of it. But so having this podcast kind of documenting the process and the project from his lab, I think is a good way of celebrating his work as well.
Thank you, Valerie. Thank you for sharing. It was wonderful to speak to you.
It was awesome to speak with you guys.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We will see you next time on For the Love of Rhododendron. So take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to For the Love of Rhododendron with your hosts, Juliana Medeiros and Ryan Fuller. We hope you enjoyed learning about rhododendron genomes and how solving this grand puzzle will advance rhododendron research across a variety of scientific disciplines. If you're keen to hear more, here's what's coming up in our next episode.
Hello, friends. Christina here. I'm excited to tell you about our next episode. Juliana and I will chat with our fellow podcast host, Ryan Fuller. Ryan is a graduate student at the University of Chicago, studying the evolution of rhododendron species in the hyper-diverse Hengdian Mountains of China. We'll hear about Ryan's adventures working in China, the challenges and opportunities presented in studying rhododendron evolution, and the surprising things he's learned along the way. See you next time.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here, you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, suggest a topic for a future episode, and get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron, and don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.